Greetings, everyone.
Greetings,
greetings everyone.
Greetings.
And good evening. I am honored to be your host for the evening. My name is Shiraz Gorman. And on the morning of August 9th, 2014, I remember being in my bedroom, and I rolled over on my right side and stared at the wall in front of me because I was completely confused on why my bedroom was so cold. See, I lived on the first floor apartment in University City, and I think my apartment forgot that it was an apartment and not a basement because for some reason it just trapped in the cold, and I started having some issues with that because I was like, why is it August? And I'm having winter negotiations with myself. And you all know what winter negotiations are. Example, if I lay in this bed about 10 to 20 more minutes under these covers, magically, the house is going to get warmer. Or maybe if I stick my leg out from under this sheet, then, you know, my body will kind of get acclimated to the cold in the house, then I'll go ahead and jump on up out of this bed and get my day started, right? So I did the most sensible thing, the most logical thing. I laid there for about another 10 to 20 minutes. And I eventually, you know, went on ahead and got up out my bed and just slowly walked myself out of my bedroom, through my hallway, and into my dining room. Because I was spending a lot of time in my dining room at that time. My dining room table would be from edge to edge, bone white sheets of paper, 8.5 by 11, with poems typed out on them spanning the 14 years of my life. Because it was the only thing that was keeping me sane at that time. Because about a week and a half before that day, I start grieving. See, on August 14th of 2013, my baby brother John was killed in the city of St. Louis. And this grieving pregame for me kind of looked like me sitting down at my dining room table with a cup of coffee, shuffling through the different pieces of poetry. And as I was sitting there that day, in the silence of my home, because my home was freakishly quiet, like you can hear the hum of my refrigerator and the ambient sounds of just trees and birds outside. And then all of a sudden that was interrupted by these rapid dings from my phone. All these different notifications start coming in from Twitter and Facebook and text messages. And at first I didn't pay it any mind. And then I decided to pick up my phone. And these images had flooded in. And there was text that accompanied these images. Some of these messages said, "Roz, the Ferguson police just shot a boy." To Roz, "It's a dead body out on Canfield Drive." And I remember going to Facebook and seeing the picture of Michael Brown's stepfather holding a son, holding a sign saying that the Ferguson PD had just executed his son. And I went more inward into my grief. And as time went by, more images came in. And the only thing I could think was, "Dear God, I hope his brothers and sisters are nowhere around to see this." Because as a person who was already preparing for the 1 year anniversary of my own brother's killing, the only thing I could think about was who is taking care of Michael Brown Jr.'s brothers and sisters. Fast forward, August 14th, the 1 year anniversary of my brother's murder. I was at the Quick Trip on Florissant. And as I looked around at people, I wondered how many folks out there were dealing with compounded issues. Because I knew that I was not unique in that situation. I knew that I was not the only person who had lost a loved one and was grieving that. And I still wonder that to this day. The storytellers that we are bringing up this evening have put their hearts and souls into their stories. And I will humbly ask you all to honor them by granting them your full attention. Because this is not easy work to do. To stand before an audience and to put your heart and your most vulnerable thoughts out to the public. And I would like for us to be mindful that we are in a sanctuary, and for us to remember what that word means: safety. So with no further ado, I would like to bring up our first storyteller, Mr. Gregory Carr.
August 9th, 2014 taught me three valuable lessons. The first lesson is the power of social media. The second lesson it taught me is that when you step outside of your comfort zone, you learn more about yourself. And the third lesson is learn to see life through other people's eyes. You see, August 9th, 2014 was a day like any other day. I was out fishing with my brother Daryl, and we were over in East St. Louis at Frank Holton Park. And we were out there about 6 o'clock in the morning, and we were it was about 80 degrees already, so it was one of those hot, sticky St. Louis days that sticks to your t-shirt. You know, you're just already wet with sweat. And we didn't catch anything. And so I drove him home to Florissant, and I dropped him off, and I simply told my brother, I said, I don't want to drive down West Florissant because I don't want Ferguson police to harass me. So I took 270 to 170 to 70 back to my home in Normandy. The first thing I did, like I always do, is I got on Facebook and started looking at what was on my timeline. And as I began to look, I started to see very distressing messages about a young man being killed, a young man laying in the streets. And when I jumped on Twitter, I saw somebody say, OMFG. I just saw somebody die today, bro. Fast forward a week later, August 16th. By this time, I had become a fully engaged social media warrior, and I'm debating everybody on social media, and I'm debating back and forth about police brutality, what is really a riot. And yes, I unfriended a whole lot of people. But there was one message that stood out to me. It was a high school friend of mine. Her name was Adrienne, and she started talking about the conditions of her neighborhood, and she was talking about the sound of gunfire and protesters and police. And she asked a very poignant question. She said, am I crazy? And I simply said, no, Adrian, you're not crazy. It sounds like what you've described for us are conditions of war. And maybe you're suffering from PTSD. Is there anything I can do for you? She said, yes. Could you please bring me some groceries? I can't get out of my subdivision. I need basic staples like milk and eggs and bread. And could you bring me some magazines? Because helping me to get away from this, I could just read a little while, to get away for a little while. This was also my last weekend of being able to have some freedom because I had to start school in a very short time, and this was my orientation week for Harris Stowe. And that Monday, I got busy with meeting with administrators and going to departmental meetings that the day got away from me. And it was 8 o'clock at night, and I called Adrian. I said, Adrian, I'm so sorry, the day got away from me. And I have the groceries for you, can I come over? She said, no, very sharply, it's too late. I said, but it's 8 o'clock, it can't. She said, they don't allow anybody in Ferguson after 5 o'clock, there's a 5 o'clock curfew. Unless you live here, you can't come in here. So, can you come back tomorrow around 3 o'clock? I said, sure, that'd be a better time. So I'm driving down Lucas and Hunt. And as I'm stopped at the stoplight on Lucas and Hunt, suddenly there is a convoy of Humvees, and suddenly I am boxed in by Humvees and National Guardsmen, and we're driving down Lucas and Hunt, and I was so relieved to make a left turn to get away from them because they went on straight ahead to the Target parking lot where there were hundreds of news trucks and other Humvees. I shortly turned into Adrian's subdivision, and I went inside. I knocked on the door, and she gave me a big hug. I brought her the groceries. I said, how are you doing, Adrian? She said, I'm managing. I said, well, we don't have to talk about the Mike Brown incident right now. We don't have to talk about everything that you talked about on Facebook. I said, I haven't seen you in so long. I said, tell me something about yourself, because I hadn't seen her in 20 years. She said, well, I have two twin boys. They're young men, they're 20 years old, and they both have dreadlocks, and I'm worried about them all the time because they get racially profiled. And I said, well, I have a 13-year-old. He loves soccer, and he's a happy-go-lucky kid, and he walks around with earbuds in his ears, and he's not very attentive at times to his surroundings. And I'm concerned about him, too, because he's big for his age. So we had that in common, that we were both concerned parents. And then all at once, our conversation was interrupted by a fly. And Adrian became fixated with this fly, and she would not stop until she killed this fly. 10 minutes later, and she sat down, and she was shaking. I said, Adrian, are you okay? She said, no. I said, why did you need to kill that fly? She said, because that fly was so loud. It was as loud as the helicopter that's been over my house for 10 days straight. And the lights pouring into my bedroom window that I cannot sleep, and the sound of gunfire, and she was very upset. And just as I went to console her, there was a knock at the door. And she said, you're the only person I invited over. Who could it be? I said, I don't know. This is your house. She said, well, could you answer? I said, this is your house. What do I do? She said, could you please answer it? I said, okay. So I walked to the door, and I opened the door, and there was a young white man. He had a blue Oxford shirt, blue jeans, and tennis shoes. He had an armful of I Heart Ferguson signs. And he said, can I put a sign on your front lawn? Because we want to show that Ferguson is united. This is not the Ferguson that we know, because the media is painting Ferguson in a very bad light. I said, well, sir, I don't live here. I'm just visiting my friend. I said, you might want to address it to her. And so, would you like to come in? So he came in, and he said, well, I'm from Ferguson, and I am a product of Ferguson Forest Schools. I went to McClure, and I had a lot of black friends. And we all got along. We didn't have any racial problems. And of course, Adrian and I looked at each other with a side eye, and we nodded. And then suddenly we're having this conversation about this sign, and he said, I really need you to put this sign in your front lawn because it shows that we're unified. And Adrian simply said, I'm just not quite ready to put that sign in my yard. He said, no, I think it would be a really good sign to put in your yard. And I realized it was no longer a request, but a demand. And so I stepped in, I said, I think she's told you she doesn't want to put the sign in her yard, and I think you should respect it. Well, I think it's a good sign. I said, it might be, but I don't think she wants to put it in her yard just yet, and I think you should respect that. And Jesse is about to leave. He said, well, would you like to have one? And I said, okay, I'll take one. He said, because we need people outside of Ferguson to realize that this is not the Ferguson that we grew up in. I said, okay, well, very good. And he went on his way, and he went on to the other houses down the street. Days later, I received a phone call because of a viral interview that I did online that I had an opportunity to go on NPR with The Takeaway with John Hockenberry. And they asked me to bring my son because I talked about in this interview how I had to have the talk with my son. So as we're sitting in the studio and preparing, he said, I'm going to ask a question. And Dad, I don't want you to interrupt. I said, all right. And he asked my son a very pointed question. He said, Gregory, have you ever been racially profiled by the police? Have you ever been afraid of the police? And I looked at him because I didn't know what to say. Because we'd just had the talk the night before. He said, yes. Yes, I have. And I am in shock because we had not talked about this. And he said, tell me about it. He said, we got racially profiled coming from a basketball game in South County, and the police stopped us, and they put the flashlights in our eyes, and they harassed our coach, and they harassed every single one of us. So what do I take away from this? I say the social media is a powerful weapon, because if it weren't for social media, I would have never seen the seriousness and the gravity of what happened to Mike Brown. Mike Brown's body laid on that ground for 4.5 hours in 90-degree heat, and all the world was able to see it. Had it not been for social media, I wouldn't have stepped outside of my comfort zone and asked Adrian, what could I do to help you? And I learned about not only who she was, but I learned about more of who I was. And lastly, I got to see life through somebody else's eyes, because I started thinking about how much I wanted to protect Adrian from this person who wanted to force this sign on her. And I started thinking about my happy-go-lucky 13-year-old son who was asked this very adult-like question, and I wanted to protect him, but I couldn't. And then I started thinking about Adrian's two sons with dreadlocks who get profiled, but she could still touch them and say hello to them and hug them. And I could still say hello to my 13-year-old son who's now 18 years old and just went to college. But Mike Brown Sr. and Leslie McSpadden, all they have is memories. Because then I realized that Mike Brown wasn't just their son. He was our son, too. Thank you.
Thank you again to Mr. Gregory Carr. So, Mr. Carr, why was it important for you to tell this particular story?
Why was it important to tell this particular story is because that incident that happened with my friend Adrian and I was like a microcosm of what's wrong with race relations in America. People are busy talking at each other, not talking to each other, and people are not listening. What Adrian clearly articulated was, I need some time to think about this, and I don't want to jump on this bandwagon, put this sign, because this sign wasn't just a sign, it was political. It was loaded with politics. It was loaded with innuendo. And she said, no, I'm not gonna let you force that on me. But this young man was so insistent, he wasn't really asking. He was simply telling her, this is what you're going to do. And that's what's been wrong with America, is we don't listen, we try to tell people what to do. And Ferguson is simply a microcosm of what's happening in America. And I don't have to tell you, all you need to do is turn on any of the cable news networks to see what's going on in America. White supremacists shooting people for the color of their skin. But we need to change this. And the only way we can change this is to stand up, speak our truths, make our voices heard, and reach out to one another.
Thank you again, Gregory Carr. And we know that the content of this evening, for the lack of a better term, for some may be triggering. Being in this very space this evening is bringing back a lot of memories for people who are present in this space. So I would like the representatives from Behavioral Health Response to stand up. This evening we have BHR in the room. Everybody give them a round of applause. So Behavioral Health Response They are in control of the 24-hour suicide hotline here in Missouri. They also provide counseling and 24-hour counseling. And we have them on site this evening for them to assist anyone who may be in need of their services or in need of a referral. So thank you again, BHR, for being present in this space, for giving of your service. Thank you. And it is my honor to bring up our next storyteller, Aziza Binti.
Good evening. If anyone would have even hinted that I had an issue with not loving black men, with not supporting black men, with not caring about black men, I would have been very upset, to say the least. My first response probably would have been something like, I have black brothers, black nephews, and cousins, so you must not know me very well at all. Probably a few expletives, which I choose not to say in this space, would have been added to. But by the summer of 2014, I would be faced with a reality that terrified me and made me feel ashamed. Neither one of those things would keep me from uncovering the truth, my truth. I met my best friend Danny in 2013. We were both at a friend's home filled with area black poets who were like the dopest people in the world. It was amazing. And Danny struck me as kinder and sweeter than I'd really ever known a man to be. It kind of gave him some points in my book. It would be months later, before Danny and I would link up again, he reached out to me to ask me to photograph a union event that he didn't have capacity to do himself. Those conversations led to us really getting to know each other better. I mean, this brother was really cool. We talked for hours on end about everything, it seemed like. We hung out, we went to the movies, went out to eat. But there was one thing that was missing. Danny had never actually been in my home. Well, he came by to pick me up, hung out places, but that was different than being in the house. So it was a little after midnight. Danny hit me up. That's not unusual. But this time he wanted to come by. Hey Z, what you up to? I responded, oh, I'm just chilling, doing some editing. What about you? Oh, well, I'm in the area and I just wanted to stop by. Yo! This is me looking at the phone. You want to do what? I mean, I'm a lesbian, he's straight, it should be cool. But I'm still a woman, he's a man. Oh no. So I sat there frozen and a little confused. Why was I afraid to let my friend come through? I mean, if it was my homegirl, yeah, come on girl, we finna chill. So I responded, you know what? I'm actually getting a little tired, bro. I'm gonna catch you another time. Danny's response was probably something chill, like, oh, okay, no problem. That's what's up, whatever. Disaster averted. Or so I thought. That night, I had nightmares about my friend. He wasn't my friend in these nightmares. He was something else. I woke up crying that next morning, confused. Why had someone so kind and sweet, who I enjoyed in my life, triggered such fear for me with a simple request to hang out? That afternoon, Danny texted again. Hey, Ziza, what you up to? I'm chilling, just editing. What about you? Yo, I'm in the neighborhood. Maybe I can stop by since it was too late yesterday. Okay. Because by this time, I figured I needed to face this. I needed to move past it. So I was still afraid, but I said, yeah, man, come through. We can have some lunch. I immediately got on the horn, texting my friend, Allison. Allison, hey, I need a favor, friend. Danny's coming over for the first time, and can you come over at the same time? She was like, cool, no problem. Didn't even ask me why. Great. So it's all set. Allison will be here. Danny will come over. I'll make a dope lunch, because I can't cook. We'll have a good time. They'll leave along with the fear, right? Okay. So Allison came over a little bit before Danny. She comes in. Hey, friend, what's going on? Oh, I'm just chilling. You know me. Just finished editing. And she says, did something happen with you and Danny? I didn't ask, you know, when you text me, but did something happen? Nah, friend, nothing happened, but Danny's never been in my home, and I don't know, I'm just feeling kind of anxious about it. She said, oh, I understand. It's no big deal. Once he comes over, you know, you'll shake that. I was really hoping she would be right, because I wanted to move past it. Danny arrived, we all chilled, it was a good time, we laughed, we talked about everything. It was time for them to go, they left. The fear stayed. The fear stayed with me. I was trying to navigate how to navigate these feelings and emotions. A few weeks later, I was in my living room on my computer, and the statuses started to hit my Facebook page. Yo, the police shot somebody in Canfield. I was used to hearing about the police killing people in St. Louis and all the other cities I lived in. I chose to believe that the person who got shot probably did something, and that's why it happened. That's what I believed at the time. But this was different. This was a boy. This was an 18-year-old boy. His body continued to lay in that street, and the images kept flooding my page, and I wanted them to stop. I felt like it was disrespectful to share those images. And then post like, yo, I'm not saying he deserved to die, but these kids are mad disrespectful. Those words burned in my mind that any of us could think that way about any of us. I decided to take the streets. I'm a filmmaker and a photographer by trade. And by August 12th, I was in those streets, photographing and filming and capturing these images with people who later became the artivist. At the time, nobody had a name. We was just out there trying to make some type of change. Danny got back from Canada. He had been gone during this time, texting, saying, hey, Z, you okay? I'm good, man. I'm doing the best I can do. He got back and began to photograph actions himself, but we were never at the same actions at the same time. But I worried about my friend. I kept thinking, what if that had been Danny? Or my brothers, or my nephews, or my cousins? That hurt to think. But it also hurt to know that Mike was someone's brother and cousin and son. I didn't know what to do with all of the feelings I had about what was going on with Danny and I. I realized that when Mike was killed, I immediately was able to see him as a boy taken from our society. I was immediately able to feel compassion for his family and their loss. That meant something to me. And it made me realize that the way that I saw black men before that moment wasn't in that way. I did not see them fully, and I couldn't understand why. Why so many black men in my family, yet there seems to be this disconnect for black men outside of my family? And I wanted to close that gap, to heal that chasm. I began to navigate these feelings that I was having and challenge myself to see things differently. I began to have conversations and critically think about where these thoughts had come from. Why was I so afraid of black men? Who planted those beliefs in my mind? Because they seemed foreign to me. They didn't belong to me. They weren't mine. And so as I began to do that, I started pouring that energy into my work, into every conversation I had, whether it was social media, whether it was a conversation at a grocery store. It was everything in me. And I began to see black men differently. I started seeing them everywhere. I mean, loving on little kids, reading stories on the porch, walking with their partners arm in arm. And it struck me, where had these men been all along? Invisible. I had rendered them invisible. And choosing to challenge myself on another level made them visible. Their loveliness, their beauty, their silliness, their gruffness, their gentleness. I began to see them in their wholeness, and I too began to heal. You know, I think that's how everybody deserves to be seen. Whole. Complete. Everyone. Every single one. Thank you.
Thank you, Aziza Binti. And breathe.
Yeah.
So why was it important for you to tell this particular story this evening?
It was important for me to tell this particular story because of the amount of shame and hurt that I experienced. I had hoped that if anyone else had been struggling with those things, that they would understand that they weren't alone, and that these thoughts, these beliefs, these were planted, they're not our own. And we can do the work to dismantle that. We can do the work to heal to let go of that. We need that. That's courageous love, when you can say, I'm afraid. I have these thoughts, I have these feelings, I have this experience, and I want to share, I want to heal, I want to get better. And I'm hoping, I am trusting that that is the case. Thank you.
Thank you again, Aziza Binti.